evening, and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juneau, 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Stay tuned for tonight's exciting show. In the first part of the show tonight, I'll be interviewing Fran Ulmer. From 7:30 to 8 p.m. in the second half, I'll have Ben Huff, local Juneau-based photographer, on the Alaska Identity Project. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can post a question there on the wall. The show is also on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And you can also find my blog, Adrienne Chile, like the country, .blogspot.com, and see the latest recordings each week from the show here on K2. Tonight's guest, the first guest, Fran Ulmer. She was appointed chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission by President Obama in March 2011. Ms. Ulmer served as chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage, Alaska's largest public university, from 2007 to 2011. She previously served as a member of the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore oil drilling. She has also served as a member of the Aspen Institute's Commission on Arctic Climate Change, held board positions with the Alaska Nature Conservancy, the National Parks Conservation Association, among many others. And during her more than 30 years of working in public service on the local, state, and national levels, Ms. Ulmer has helped to shape both public and environmental policy. She served as an elected official for over 18 years between being mayor of Juneau, a state representative, and lieutenant governor of Alaska. Fran, thanks for being on the show tonight. And first off, thank you for your amazing service to the state of Alaska over the past 30 years.
Well, thank you, Adrienne, and thanks for inviting me to be part of the call. I just wish I were back home in Juneau. I spent 30 years living there, met my husband there, raised our kids there, and have many friends there. Wish I were with you.
Oh, wow. Well, the weather's not so great tonight. I don't know if you want to be here. Well, let's start off by talking about some of your most recent activities, being appointed to the chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. Can you give us a little background on just what this commission's role is, its mission, and what you're doing now as chair of the group?
Certainly. The commission was created back in 1984 by Congress. It's kind of an unusual body because it's an independent federal agency with private citizens sitting on the commission. The job of the commission really is to identify the goals for Arctic research for federal agencies and to help provide advice to the agencies, to Congress, to the president about federal research policy for the Arctic. The entity has existed, as I said, since 1984, which was when Senator Frank Murkowski introduced the bill and it passed. And since that time, the commission has focused on a lot of issues of importance to Alaska that are still very much in the news today, needing more research about things that really matter to the health and well-being of Alaska residents, to our infrastructure, to our very special environment. The commission produces a report every 2 years, which can be found on the web at arctic.gov, and it identifies these goals and objectives, and it also lists a number of white papers and other research products that come as a result of the work of the commission.
Wow, wow. Now, yeah, I was actually looking on the website, and the last report was published in 2009-2010, so there's going to be another one coming up soon.
It will be released next week at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium here in Anchorage. And so basically by the middle of next week, it will be available not only in hard copy but online as well. So, yeah, fresh off the press, the new version next week.
Great, great. Any advance information you can give us?
Well, I think the nature of the report isn't so much groundbreaking news as it is trying to focus the energy, attention, and resources of the various federal agencies and, for that matter, foundations and universities that do research in the Arctic to really focus on the things that are the most important, the most urgent from the standpoint of people making decisions, both in the public sector and in the private sector. So, I encourage people who are interested in Arctic research to go take a look, but I also want to encourage people to comment, because the nature of the commission is really supposed to be an outreach effort to members of the public, to people who do research, to business leaders, to people in the agencies who are actually on the ground doing things for state, federal, and local government. So it would be great to get feedback from people who would take the time to look at the report and provide us information, because that's the only way we can really reflect what it is that people who live in the Arctic or the near Arctic are thinking about, caring about, and need research to help them make choices about.
Definitely. Do you find a lot of Alaskans are interested in these issues beyond just the companies and main agencies?
Absolutely. And you know, interestingly enough, Adrienne, I think if you went back 10 or 15 years ago and just did kind of a search, a web search, or a newspaper search of, you know, how many articles in the lower 48 news articles actually had anything to do with the Arctic, it would be much less than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the Arctic really has taken center stage, not just for people who live in Alaska, for people who live in the United States and around the world. This is happening for a lot of reasons, not to mention, you know, for good reasons. We hope that people are paying more attention to these questions that are facing people about Arctic development and about life in the Arctic. But it's really true. For a long time, people really thought the Arctic was, like, you know, far away, out of sight, out of mind, but a lot more attention and concern about the future of the Arctic, not only because of climate change and oil and gas development, but because of things like infectious diseases and species, the extent to which species are either under a great deal of pressure or are going extinct. This is on people's list of things to care about and to pay attention to, which is quite a change from where it was 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Well, what about back in 2006? I know I had Mead Treadwell, current Lieutenant Governor, on a few months ago, and he talked just about the Arctic Council meeting in Russia a few months ago. And so you've both been chairs of this commission. Have you seen changes since just his time serving as chair?
You know, it's really kind of funny. You know, I used to be Lieutenant Governor, and now Mead is, and he's the chair of the commission, and now I am. We had coffee together and talked about learning from each other, and we do talk quite a bit about things that we can not only contribute to, but people that we know that can be of assistance, not only from the standpoint of Arctic issues, but from the standpoint of his current job, things like elections management. So we do talk. And yes, I think if Mead were on this call, he would say that during the time that he chaired the commission, he also witnessed the steady increase in interest and attention and investment, not just in the research community, but investment by individuals and by businesses. What we have certainly been mostly concerned about lately is the lack of infrastructure in the Arctic to be able to support the increased development, which is not only taking place, but likely to take place at an increased rate. And that's not just true for Alaska and for Canada. It's true for Russia. It's true for Greenland and Norway. The extent to which the hoped for development, the plans for marine shipping and other transportation modes, the necessary investments that must be made by the Coast Guard, by the federal government, by others to make sure that this kind of development can be done as safely as possible given the challenging conditions in the Arctic.
Yeah, of course. And we even see right now the Russian tanker trying to get into Nome, and I was talking to some friends in the Coast Guard, and they said that we don't actually have a tanker that can get in there. And I was just wondering, well, is Russia more prepared than us in the Arctic?
Yes.
Yeah.
They have 8 nuclear-powered submarines.
Wow.
And are in the process of building 2 more.
Wow.
China has the largest non-nuclear Arctic-capable icebreaker in the world, and they're building a second one. The ice-breaking capacity of other countries like Russia and Canada definitely should be a wake-up call for the United States. And I think you're right. The recent ongoing incident in Nome, the lack of fuel, the inability for people who live in Nome to be able to get the fuel at a reasonable price and under what is now pretty emergency conditions, it definitely highlights our national needs to be ready for conditions that are very, very challenging. And I'm hopeful that the kind of coverage that is currently taking place in terms of our one and only functional icebreaker being able to actually help a Russian tanker get into Nome is painting a picture for people, particularly the appropriators that in Congress are a very important part of being able to solve this problem and meet this national need.
Yeah. Well, not just in Congress. I mean, the session here in Juneau is starting soon. Are there any expectations on our legislators with the Arctic issues in Alaska?
Well, as you may know, the recently produced report by the Alaska Northern Waters Task Force is definitely a very good way of getting Alaskans to think about not only what the issues are, but also what role state government could and should play. I've looked at the draft report, and I'm not real clear on whether the most recent draft is the one that I found on the web or not, but I'm sure it will be in final form soon. It lays out a number of key issues, and a number of those issues are things that the state of Alaska has an important role to play. The six areas that report addresses: Arctic governance, Arctic planning and infrastructure investment, oil and gas development, Arctic fisheries, marine transportation, and Arctic research. Some of all of those issues are federal responsibility, but some of them are also a state issue. So I think it's great that task force has really done the work that it's done, and I'm hopeful that Alaska legislators will take to heart the work of that task force.
Great. Let's hope so. One of our listeners wrote in and asked about the importance of collaboration with Canada on some of these issues, and especially on mapping the Arctic Ocean floor.
Canada is an important partner for the United States in many ways, but absolutely the mapping of the Beaufort, the Chukchi, the nearshore areas, and the potential Northwest Passage transportation systems that may evolve over time is something that is very important for our two countries to do together. And it only makes sense not only because of the proximity issues, but also because of the long-standing cooperation that the United States and Canada has had on many levels. The rough equivalent to the U.S. Arctic Research Commission in Canada is something called the Canadian Polar Commission. And our commissions are going to meet jointly in April in Montreal. And some of our agenda for that meeting is to lay out the ways in which currently the Arctic science community in both the United States and Canada are working together, but to find some of the areas, the gaps that could be better addressed by having more attention paid both by the Canadian and U.S. government to link up our funding sources so that joint research can be more effective, more bang for the buck. So it's a very timely point that is raised by the person who called in or wrote in. The mapping is a huge problem for the Arctic. A lot of both the Northern Sea Route above Russia and the Northwest Passage above Canada and Alaska is inadequately mapped and charted. And if there is going to be increased transportation, and that there's already been increased shipping, particularly in the Northern Sea Route arena over Russia, for that shipping to be safe, the mapping needs to be done much more completely than it has been to date. And of course, it's easy to understand why. It's expensive, it's time-consuming, it's hard work, but it's essential.
Yeah, definitely. Now, have you been able to spend more time up in these areas since you became chair?
Well, over the years, not just in the last year, but over the years, I have visited many of the countries of the Arctic, Greenland and Norway and Finland and Sweden and Russia and Canada and Iceland this summer.
So I've
had my foot in the north for the last 30 or 40 years for a variety of reasons. But I think, you know, to a certain extent, the ways in which the northern countries, the eight Arctic nations that are part of the Arctic Council, come together on joint projects, there's really been a long legacy of that. And that's very, very healthy. The Arctic Council has been a very instrumental entity for pulling together on an issue basis, research, collaboration, sharing of information and best practices. And so even for people who haven't had the opportunity to actually travel to a lot of the Arctic nations, just reading the work that has been done by the Arctic Council and its various working groups and task forces would give people a really good view into the conditions of the Arctic and the challenges in the Arctic. So that's another place people who are listening who are particularly interested in learning more about the Arctic, going to the Arctic Council website and getting information about the various working groups and the reports that they've produced over the years on everything from tourism to now one of their big projects is being able to respond more effectively to potential oil spills in the Arctic, and the search and rescue agreement that was signed by the Arctic Council, Arctic 8, back in May in Greenland.
Yeah, and we'll encourage, again, people to go to arctic.gov to give comments on the report that's going to be released next week. People are listening out there. Well, speaking of oil spills, Fran, you, before this, you were chair of the, or not chair, but a member of the National Commission, the BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill. And that report was actually published a year ago yesterday. That was, I think so, right? The 11th of January?
Yes, you're exactly right. We were celebrating a one-year anniversary.
A one-year anniversary. I'm still trying to read the whole report. But what would you say were some of the key results of this investigation that we should know about if people don't get time to read the report?
Well, first of all, the oilspillcommission.gov is the website, and the oilspillcommission.gov website, in addition to the full report, has kind of a summary report of just the specific recommendations. So even though the big report is a little intimidating, the shorter version of the summary recommendations is something that I would recommend if you want to kind of go right to the heart of it. But the commission had two jobs, basically. One job to look at the cause, the underlying causes of the accident, and number two, to make recommendations that would help improve the safety of operations of deep water oil and gas drilling in the future. And the oil and gas activities, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, at one level, it's really astounding how much activity has evolved over the last 30 years in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a highly developed area with a lot of very sophisticated technology and a lot of companies that work very hard at not only getting the oil out but trying to do it safely. But our report talks a lot about the underlying causes of the complacency that had evolved in the sense that people felt that they didn't have to go the extra mile to really make certain that they were controlling the situation that is, of course, a very, very dangerous one on these rigs. Mm-hmm. And if you take the time to look at the description of really what went wrong on the Deepwater Horizon rig that day, you will see that it wasn't just one thing, it wasn't just two things. There were multiple system failures, any one of which should have triggered on behalf of, you know, both the people who were sitting on that rig and the people who were back on land at headquarters reviewing the information that they were receiving from the rig should have sent up red flags and stopped the operation and really could have, should have, kept that disaster from happening. Mm-hmm. So our recommendations really speak to the extra safety precautions that can and should be taken by industry. But the report also makes recommendations for the federal agencies and for Congress. So our recommendations are kind of three-part, for the industry, for the federal agencies, and for Congress. And I guess a year after the report is released, sort of what I would say in summary, the good news is that industry has taken some significant steps to make drilling in the Gulf of Mexico safer, including standing up two different containment systems and putting in place a safety institute that's part of API and a number of other things. Not everything that perhaps needs to be done, but they have taken action. And similarly, the federal agencies, the Department of Interior, Secretary Salazar completely reorganized the old Minerals Management Service into several different sections that would allow a clearer focus on safety and separated that from leasing. So a number of the recommendations that the commission made for federal agencies have, not all, again, but many, have been adopted. Unfortunately, Congress has not done any of the things that our report recommended. For example, increasing liability limits, increasing the amount of money available in to be able to respond to a disaster, increasing the amount of money available for oil spill response research. A number of the things that only Congress can do have yet to be done. And so we're hoping that as time goes by, that there might be more of a willingness on the part of not just industry and the federal agencies, but also Congress, to respond appropriately to this disaster and take the necessary steps to improve safe operations that are good for not just the workers and the environment, but for the industry and for the economy of the regions impacted by such a terrible tragedy as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just 20 years before, we had the oil spill in Exxon Valdez, in my hometown, actually. Did you feel that some of your experience working with the Exxon Valdez helped in this case, or were they just completely different, being offshore in a tanker?
Well, there were a lot of differences in terms of what actually happened in terms of the incident. And yes, of course, a lot of differences between Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. But there were an extraordinary number of similarities in terms of the way in which it impacted people's lives. And talking to the people in Louisiana was very much like it was talking to people in Cordova and Valdez and the Prince William Sound area after the 1989 spill, in terms of the pain and the suffering, the uncertainty, the economic crush, particularly for fishermen, but there for oyster farmers and for shrimpers. And, you know, in some very strange ways, Louisiana and Alaska are a lot alike. In both states, oil and gas, fishing, and tourism are really the heart of the economy of both states. Oil and gas, fishing, and tourism. And they exist sort of, they can coexist pretty well as long as there isn't a huge disaster, as long as people are paying attention, as long as the people are going the extra mile for safety. So, yeah, there was actually a lot of communication back and forth between people in Alaska and people in Louisiana and in the Gulf Coast region. A lot of folks from Alaska went down to help work on the spill. Local government officials, people who went through the Exxon Valdez disaster, did counseling and helped people in the Gulf area. And it was, for me, as an Alaskan, helpful to be able to connect not only people and institutions, but ideas. For example, the RCAC, the Regional Citizens Advisory Councils that evolved in Alaska after the Exxon Valdez spill, that idea really was a popular one in the Gulf of Mexico, as something that they would like to have after the spill that they experienced, so that local people can be more actively engaged in interacting with the federal agencies, with the industry, and helping to be a voice for people for planning for spills and for being ready in case there is one. So yes, long answer, but your question is right on. There are differences in terms of what caused the spills, but some significant similarities and some transferability between what we have learned and what they, I believe, could benefit from the lessons learned in Alaska. Just one really interesting point, Adrienne. Yeah. After the Exxon Valdez oil spill, Congress passed the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite a contrast to today, where Congress has not taken any of the specific actions necessary, including funding restoration in the Gulf of Mexico, which is a huge need given the way in which that Gulf needs, for a wide variety of reasons, investment to restore the marshes and the wetlands and the ability of that region to be able to handle not only things like oil spills, but hurricanes and the pressures associated with the kind of development that's taken place there for the last 50 years.
Yeah. Now, will BP fund some of that restoration? I mean, will there be similar claims just like the Exxon Valdez?
Well, there are lots of lawsuits pending.
Yeah.
And the commission had nothing to do with those, and the commission actually doesn't exist anymore. I mean, when we produced our report, a year ago, we met with the president at the White House. We spent an hour with his key cabinet officials that had worked on the spill. We talked through our findings and our recommendations, and that was the end of our job. I mean, we were given 6 months to do our work, and we finished our work on time, under budget, and with a unanimous decision, which is kind of rare these days.
Yeah, so that's done. Any follow-up reports, you think, in 10 or 20 years?
Well, the commissioners, even though we don't officially exist anymore, have agreed that because we feel pretty strongly that there is room for improvement in the way in which not only the industry and the agencies, but also the communities and the states work together to respond to spills, and that not only more research, but also more planning and more preparation and more prevention is absolutely key if we're going to continue to drill, as we will continue to drill, not just in the Gulf of Mexico, but in Alaska and a lot of other places. So we're committed as people who spent time getting educated and became very convinced of what needs to be done, that we are going to issue annually report cards.
Oh, wow.
On how the industry, how federal agencies, and how Congress is doing on making progress toward making the industry and the operations in our waters as safe as possible.
Wow. Every year. So every January there'll be a report card coming out. So this
month. You know, we haven't decided yet whether we're going to do it in January when we did the report or in April when the spill occurred. We haven't decided which is the most appropriate date for the report card, but we're committed to doing that because we don't want to let the report, the recommendations, and the effort to make change die. We want to see those changes happen.
Definitely, definitely. Speaking of change, we don't have a lot of time left here. Of course, I only got through half the questions, but just bringing it back to Alaska, especially women here in Alaska, would you give any advice, or anyone who wants to serve in public office, what kind of advice do you have?
I have found public service to be incredibly personally satisfying from the standpoint of being able to, every single day, learn something new, meet really interesting and committed people, and help be part of solving problems. I really encourage young people to think seriously about public service. And there are a variety of ways to serve, but my advice, particularly for somebody who maybe is just beginning their career and beginning to think about how they might do public service, is to volunteer. Start with volunteering. Volunteer in an area that you have a personal commitment, a passion for, something you really care about, whether that's working on parks or, you know, at a homeless shelter or whatever it may be. Start with volunteering. I would also recommend serving on local advisory committees. Pretty much every community, every mayor, every assembly and city council, they have local advisory committees on a wide variety of topics. You can get some experience working with others, problem solving, articulating your feelings about things in ways that other people can understand where you're coming from. Those are the kind of skill sets that can be very helpful to you as you move through your career in the public or private sector, but it can also help you decide how you best can serve, how you can match up your skills, your passion with a job that needs to be done. And Lord knows there are plenty of jobs that need to be done.
Yeah, definitely. Well said. Thank you, Fran. I really appreciate taking the time this half hour. I know it's been tough to pin you down. You're the busiest person I know. But good. Best of luck with the coming years on the Arctic Research Commission, and thanks again.
Thanks for the opportunity, and I do encourage people to go to these websites and provide us with some comments.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fran. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll be back after this short break with Ben Huff, local Juneau-based photographer and Project Last Road North. Stay tuned here on the Alaska Identity Project. Lopez broadcasting here on KTO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks to Fran Ulmer in the first half hour. She did a great job, made a half hour of her time to call into our show tonight. In the next part, we'll be talking with Ben Huff. He is a local Juneau-based photographer, and I'm going to read his bio here. He is working on a project called The Last Road North, which has been widely exhibited around the state of Alaska, including a solo show at the Pratt Museum in Homer. His work is included in the American Now exhibition at Montserrat Gallery in Beverly, Massachusetts, and the traveling exhibition 100 Portraits, 100 Photographers in 2010. Ben has been published in Humble Arts Collector's Guide to Emerging Art Photography, PDN Magazine, and Russian Empire. Photographs from The Last Road North have been collected by the Museum of the North in Fairbanks, Alaska, and the Alaska State Museum. PDN, Ben, what does that mean?
It's essentially a trade publication.
Okay.
Photo District News is the is the full, I guess, the non-acronym title, and they did a feature last February.
Okay.
Probably the kind of the premier photography trade magazine in the country, and they were great. Connor, the photo editor there who did the interview, was smart and thorough, and it was it was a nice article.
A nice article. Is this on your website, right? You can find some of these articles?
It is, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which we'll throw that out a couple times, huffphoto.com.
Yep, absolutely, yeah.
I went through the first time thinking Huffington Post, and I'll never forget your website.
I think a few people probably make that mistake, maybe.
But that's okay. Well, if you're out there listening tonight, you can actually log on to huffphoto.com and be watching or looking at some of your pictures.
Yeah.
As we talk about this project, which is called The Last Road North. So give me a little context, background, how this started, what made you go up and do a project on this road?
It's a good question. My wife and I moved to Fairbanks in 2005 from Colorado.
Okay.
She was going to graduate school up at UAF. And in 2007, we made a road trip, just a day trip up to the Arctic Circle, because that's kind of what you do. And the road is just so unique and burly. It's mostly dirt. The first, as soon as your tires hit the pavement off the Elliott, it's just up and down, and it's rutted, and if it's raining, it's nasty, and it's thick mud, and it's just kind of this impossible little, this narrow stretch of road that runs, 500 miles, 414 plus the Elliott 75.
Mm-hmm.
And the Arctic Circle isn't really that far. It's a little over 100 miles up the road.
From the end of the road.
Right, just, 100 miles, 175 from Fairbanks.
Okay.
So 100 miles up the Dalton,
the
Hall Road, right.
Yeah.
And I got home, and I was just intrigued by what was after that. We really hadn't gone that far. And visually, it's not even all that spectacular. The Arctic Circle is actually a little anticlimactic, it's geographically, and once you kind of think of the space, it's really wonderful, but it's visually... it really starts getting great about 100 miles later up the road. So I came back and I was, doing some research and just trying to find photographs and context and what had been done up there. I was just trying to find some information. And I wasn't finding a lot, And the more I started kind of thinking about it and dreaming about it and doing a little bit of research and finding some photos online, some stock photos, some travelers that have blogs. And getting just enough to kind of see what was up there, it seems kind of crazy that I was looking for something to do here, that kind of fit kind of all of the things that I kind of thought that Alaska is and that I don't think Alaska is and my naivete and all these kind of things. And I said, well, this is it. I hadn't been 100 miles on the road, and I said, this is it. I don't know what's at the end. I don't know how long it'll take. I don't even know if it's possible, but let's give her a run. So then it was just scheduling trips and making runs.
So you didn't have another project on your plate
I
at the time?
Didn't. I was making a lot of photos in Fairbanks, kind of downtown Fairbanks, Fairbanks is very kind of, I love Fairbanks to death. I'm a little homesick, actually.
Really?
But
not in January.
But it's so, downtown Fairbanks is so unspectacular.
Uh-huh.
It's like any city in the Midwest, it could be any city in Omaha or in Nebraska, and that was safe to me, and I was kind of interested in the fact that it was so banal in a way. I was spending a lot of time just walking around Fairbanks and making photos, going out and doing backpacking trips and skis and all these things, outside and out kind of off the grid a little bit. But I wasn't seeing or making photographs of the space the way that I knew that I needed to. So there's just some sort of disconnect, and the road, with the environment and the built environment and all of the things with oil. There's just so complex up there. The complexities are what really interested me, And it was kind of a little bit of all the things that I was looking for,
So did you come up with a strategy in your mind? I want to take so many pictures of the first part of the road, the last part, get stories along the way.
Actually, no.
Okay.
That's a great question though, because it seems really logical,
mm-hmm.
and it might have been easier if I had had a little bit more structure in that regard, you know. But from the very beginning, I never saw it as being like a documentary project. You know, I always wanted it to have, like, I always had this kind of idea of a feeling that always trumped the visualness of it. You know, there was always this, like, I'd get up there, you know, and there's a million things to make photographs of. Mm-hmm. And I say, I'd always come back to the same thing. I'm like, well, what does it feel like to be, you know, driving on the North Slope? You know what I mean? Yeah. What does it feel like to be going over Adigan Pass? You know, what does it feel like, you know, to come across a cross on the side of the road that is a memorial to someone dying, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was always kind of came back to that, you know, I travel alone, you know, mm-hmm. Which is really important, was for me anyway, really important for the project, that it was always kind of coming back to that feeling kind of trumped everything. And there's all these, you know, landscape and environmental and oil and politics. I think there's all sorts of things that are kind of potentially, if I hope, maybe are bubbling under the skin, maybe for people to kind of key in on.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it was always that kind of feel, you know. The portraits are all singular, you know. They're all, you know, one person, you know. A lot of them kind of have that weary kind of road weary, mm-hmm. you know, kind of after the boom, kind of we're on the bus side of things kind of look to them, you know. And as I look at them now after, you know, the project's over and I'm kind of editing things, I look at so many of them now and I'm like, well, that's kind of, probably sounds really egotistical, but I'm like, you know, those are me, you know what I mean? They're me, I'm them, you know? And I think all along that was really kind of this vein that I was trying to tap into, whether I realized that at the very beginning or not.
Yeah. Now, this project, The Last Road North, you mm-hmm. have an artist statement that talks about many things, but it's a very the last piece of it says always north or south, advancing or retreating.
Yeah.
At the end, always oil.
Yeah.
What were you trying to say here? Is this what you're saying about the complexities of the road?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, it's part of the idea is that you don't stumble across it. You know, there are no crossroads. There are no, you don't just stumble onto the Hall Road or the Dalton Highway.
How'd I get here?
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, it's a very deliberate, difficult, I mean, expensive thing to do. You know, everybody's, and I was never really interested in the people that were up there for work. You know, I was more interested in the people that were, all of them to some degree, and most of the people that I made photographs and that I was drawn to and that I really wanted to talk to, were all searching for something, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of part of that pervasiveness of that too, is that so many are looking for this idea of frontier, this idea of Alaska, you know, and whether that even exists anymore. You know, uh-huh. like, but by us actually standing there, it's not really frontier, mm-hmm. right? You know, and that, I really fought with that. Not fought with it. I mean, I embraced it, I guess. But that idea was always kind of part of that as well, you know, was that, you know, at the end, you know, you can drive all that way. You can drive for 500 miles and see just the most spectacular scenes, you know, in these heartbreaking landscapes. And it's just gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to the end and you, I mean, it's, you know, it's always there. You know, the only reason you could drive that 500 miles is because of what's at the end, you know, and regardless of whether you agree with the drilling, don't agree with the drilling. And I don't take sides and I don't propose that the work does, but the end is ugly, you know, it just is. I mean, you can't escape it.
The end,
you know?
Being Barrow?
Yeah, well, the end being Dead Horse or Prudhoe Bay,
okay,
right?
Okay.
You know, I mean, the end is, I mean, it's an industrial complex, and it's not, you know, I mean, it's where the oil comes from. I mean, there's work being done, and it's not pretty. It's not supposed to be pretty. There's no real artifice to it. It just kind of, it's very real, you know? I mean, I see people on the road every once in a while, like at Galbraith Lake or something, and they're like, God, it's so, like, amazed at what they've seen, you know, and I so bad want to tell them sometimes, you know, like at mile 413, just turn around, you know what I mean? You know, like you just, everybody has like this ideal of what Alaska is, and so much of that, I don't know, there's just a lot kind of to play
different
there.
Stories.
Yeah.
So people are out there, Ben Huff, HuffPhoto.com, and so let's look at a picture. I know there's a picture of a guy with a face kind of really rough. There's two kids with their car
right.
broken
yeah.
down. Is there any particular story or someone with a destination that was going up that road?
I mean, everybody's kind of has a story. I think, you know, kind of the biggest story of, not the biggest story, I mean, you know, the guys with the car, those are actually two Germans.
Okay. They look fine. No.
Yeah, Dirk and Torsten, they look very European, don't
they?
Yeah, they designer
do.
Jeans. And they actually came to be very good friends of mine. They stayed in Fairbanks on their way back down the road for quite a while, but they're both Volkswagen aficionados and had that Beetle shipped from Germany to Seattle.
Wow.
Drove it to Prudhoe and then actually drove the entire Pan American. So drove all the way to the southern tip of Argentina in that thing.
The southern tip of Chile, actually.
And it took them. Yeah, exactly.
The road ends in
right,
Chile.
Yeah. So, 2 years or something like that. And
they could write a book on.
They absolutely could. Yeah. And they're you know, incredible characters. And I ended up, you know, having a friendship with them later because they stayed in Fairbanks and we still actually keep in touch. But, you know, that interaction with them was, you know, 20 minutes, maybe a half hour, which is probably about the time that and most of the people, I'll never see them again. You know, that was just kind of a nice. I mean, it's nice to keep in touch with someone that's in a photograph, but it's. Mm-hmm. But it's rare, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, rare.
We try through Facebook, right?
Right.
Now, before I want to try to get as much as possible in the next 10 minutes. So, let's just wrap this piece up with what you're hoping to do. You want to publish a book with this project, The Last Road North?
I do. Yeah, I'm working on the edit now.
Okay.
And just starting to try to push it out into the world as kind of a full bit, you know,
okay.
Put a bow on it and move on to something else.
And then have another exhibit. You have had exhibits already with this.
I have, yeah. I'm working on now showing, maybe probably not the whole thing, but showing the final bit. And it's a little early to say. I have a few things that are kind of simmering. And it won't be yet this year, but I have a couple things that I'm hoping to come through for next year. So I'm hoping the middle to end of next year to start showing it. And if all goes well, it'll show multiple times. But
all right. In and outside of Alaska.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, a lot of things have to happen.
So this town of Beverly, Massachusetts, I've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
How did you get to that?
Montserrat College of Art. It was the biggest show of my career. Tremendous opportunity. Shannon Dumont, Leonie Bradbury, curators there run the gallery there, and it was six photographers, six kind of, it wasn't really billed this way, but six kind of up-and-coming photographers, I guess, for lack of a better term. Shane Lavalette and Daniel Cheek and myself, and then three of kind of the biggest names in the business, Laura McPhee, who I respect greatly, and then Zoe Strauss and Alex Soth, both who actually are friends of mine and are both brilliant and
wow.
Wonderful, and it was kind of a dream, kind of a dream show. Absolutely, yeah.
Exhibit with them.
Yeah.
Now you're also taking this role of educating or creating awareness with your work to university students, and if you're out there listening locally, you could listen to you as a professor this semester, right, Ben?
Yeah, listen to you rattle on, right?
what classes are you teaching, and what message do you want to get out to?
Yeah, I have a printing, both of them Mondays and Wednesdays.
Okay.
The printing course starts at 3 o'clock Monday and Wednesday. And then we're actually doing a book course at 5:15 on Monday and Wednesday. Printing course we've done before. And the book course is, I've taught it in Fairbanks. It'll be the first time down here.
Okay.
It's a fun course. It's appreciation and history, and we deal with a print on demand service to kind of have a book at the end of the class. We do a lot of hands on kind of book building, but it's really designed around, you know, editing and sequencing and critique, and, you know, kids, adults, whoever, to come in with bodies of work that they really want to kind of flesh out and pare down and make something kind of tangible.
Wow. Do you have
I'm looking forward to it. No, well, the print-on-demand service is something, I mean, that anyone can do. We will use the service, blurb.com.
Okay.
You know, anyone can use that software. They have templates. You can, you know, go from InDesign, PDF format. And we'll use that because the interface is just so slick. And the learning curve to, like, get up and going is really, really small. So we can kind of hit the ground running. And then we'll be dealing with you know, glue and scissors and the works as well.
Okay.
And it's fun, you know. It's a good class. It's a good class to kind of get, really roll up your sleeves and get, you know.
Get dirty.
Yeah, exactly. And get a little emotional and get, it's just
feeling.
Fun. Books are just, they're everything, you know.
So this is the first time in Juneau you'll be teaching
classes?
Absolutely,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is the first time I taught last semester the printing course. Printing course again this semester. And then 293, both of them, 293-1 and 293-2 for both the classes, if you're looking to enroll. And they start next week.
Okay.
Yeah, start next week.
And
enrollment's low, so.
Talk to anybody you know. You know anybody that's going to be in your class?
You know, I have a couple students actually from last semester that took Joel and Jill from out at the university actually that took the printing class last semester that are going to be in the book class.
Okay.
And then I recognize a few of the names. I recognize a couple of faces just from seeing them around town, but I don't know them. So, it's going to be great.
Is it expensive?
What's that?
Is it expensive? I haven't taken college classes.
I don't even know what a credit over there is. For undergrad, I hate to say, I bet for 3 credits, like $500.
Okay.
I shouldn't say it because I don't even know, but I think that's for an undergrad class, you know, special topics class. Something like that.
Okay. I can go on.
But,
the website.
Yeah, so.
Or go to your website.
Money well spent.
Yes, it will be. Now, you have these two worlds. So your work on the Dalton Project, The Last Road North, and
right.
then your teachings. How do you
right.
think these two come together?
You know, that's a good question, and I ask myself that a lot, actually. I love photography, you know, and I've mm-hmm. always, this sounds probably really strange, but I've always kind of wanted my work to be bigger than just my work, you know what I mean? And there's so little... It's a totally different discussion, but there's so little kind of history and knowledge of contemporary photography, I think, within Alaska. You know, like there's just, it's young, you know, and I don't know that we collectively, well, we don't really have a collectively, I guess. And I'm interested in advancing a dialogue, you know, I'm interested in critique. I'm interested in what our role is, even what our responsibility is as artists, as photographers, and how we're representing what we're representing, you know, and they're kind of maybe big, heady kind of questions and not really relevant to this class, to these classes, and not something we'll probably be covering. But still, at the end of the day, they're, you know, it's something that I don't know that I think about and that I'd like to be part of kind of rolling the rock up the hill, you know?
Yeah. Have you had these discussions with other Alaskan photographers?
You know, not so much down here yet. I mean, I'm kind of new and kind of getting the lay of the land, mm-hmm. you know. But we had a good group in Fairbanks, you know. Dennis Whitmer, a good friend of mine up there. Adam Schiesel, great friend of mine. Charles Mason, who's my advisor up there. Good, conscious, talented photographers. And we got together regularly, you know, and we do like salon setups where we'd look at work and we critique work. We'd look at books and we'd, you know, we'd talk about what's going on and we'd, you know, we'd look at stuff that's been done a decade ago, you know, two mm-hmm. decades ago. And where does it fit? You know what I mean? Like where does the history, you know, I don't know. You kind of, Dennis is kind of fond of saying that he's brilliant. But he'll, you know, that making a fixed picture has consequences, right? You know, that it means something. And that, you know, he always kind of looks at projects or bodies of work or if he's going to take something on and he's like, you know, does it matter? You know, in 50 years, is anybody going to care but me? And if that's the only person that's going to care, that's still enough. It's still enough to make the photographs if you're the only one that cares. You know, I mean, you do it for yourself first.
Yeah.
But it's a good question, and I think it's a valid question. You know.
Will your project matter in 50 years? Last year North.
You know, I have no idea. It's not. I don't think it's for me to say. I don't know. I think I've made some good pictures. You know, and it doesn't. I don't know. At the end of the day, that's enough, I guess, you know.
We'll see. Well,
yeah.
You've got a great website.
Thank
I
you.
Might buy one of them. Can I buy a picture?
Absolutely. We'll talk.
Huff, Ben Huff, huffphoto.com is his website. Stay tuned for the book eventually being published.
Absolutely.
The Last Road North. Google it. The Dalton Highway. there's quite a few things now. National Geographic, Ice Road, trucker stuff.
There is, yeah.
There's more and more.
Alaska's being defined one way or another. You know, it's, you know, we all, again, that's back to the responsibility, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for coming on the
Absolutely.
Show, Ben.
Thank
really
you very much.
Really appreciate it. We'll get you on next year
That'd
in the future.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and thanks to everybody listening out there. This is the Alaska Identity Project. I'll be speaking next week with Executive Director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, Ray Rieta, and an artist from Barrow, Vernon Rexford. He works with Baleen Whale Art up in Barrow, so he'll be on the show as well next week. Thanks to Martha, Jeff, Susan here in the studio. And have a good week, everybody. This is Adrienne Lopez.